Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Skinful, when Robin Fleming left Australia to wander the world as a nomadic freelance editor, she was single and nearing 60. Wasn't the first time she'd shed an old skin for a new one in the hope of changing who she was on the inside. The book is called Skinful. It charts her journey. I'm delighted to be joining me live on the line from Sydney, author of Skinful, Robin Fleming. Robin, good morning from us. Good evening to you, I believe.
Hola, yes.
Well, so you're in Sydney, and it's Australia Day any second now, then, presumably, you would say. Is it actually Australia Day on the 26th or is it on the 27th, just to refresh my grey matter?
It's Australia Day or Invasion Day, whichever way you want to look at it.
Right.
On the 26th.
Right. So if we hear some crackling in the background, that is actually, you said that's going to be fireworks rather than the invasion happening itself.
That's right.
So when this landed on my desk, I did had a smile because, you know, nomadic freelance editor, single and nearing 60. This sounds rather familiar. So give me a little bit about your life and what made you, if you like, go walkabout a bit.
Yes. Well, I was also insolvent. So there you go.
That sounds even more familiar then.
You know, I think I'm a bit of a wanderer. I think I'm a bit of a path seeker. I have found, looking back on my life, as I have done in writing this memoir, there are quite distinct turning points. And the book is structured around four of those turning points. The first one happened when I was visiting Hong Kong on a business trip for my company in Sydney, and I went back to Sydney and resigned and said, I'm going back up there. And that was in the mid-1980s. It was a very interesting time. The return to China was 12 years away, but it was in the air. And it was a fascinating time. I started to freelance then. So I had different stresses than I had had before, and my drink at the end of the day that had been sort of a social, an enjoyable part of, okay, I'm done with work for now, became a necessity over the last few years, and I struggled to come to terms with that I, you know, I'm a bit of a control freak, and alcohol was becoming the boss of me in a way that felt very uncomfortable. I'd escaped a dominating father, you know, and I didn't like this new relationship I had with alcohol. So instead of changing myself, I returned to Australia. I thought, actually, I might be going to have a breakdown. And then 16 years later, I left Australia again. I still hadn't come to terms with this dependency I developed on specifically white wine by then. And I thought, if I throw myself out into the world with no safety net, I will have to be good. I will have to, my back will be against the wall. I'm going to have to be my best self. And it still took me 15 months of struggling to, because I couldn't believe I couldn't manage this. You know, I'm a very strong girl.
Mm.
You know, I had porters in New Guinea when I was trekking muddy, you know, Kokoda track, strong girl. And I thought, why can't I manage this? Why can't I have two glasses of wine?
Yeah, I mean, what's saying, you know, cunning, baffling and powerful. That's what the saying is. What sort of journalism were you doing? Were you doing sort of lifestyle? Were you doing hard news? What sort of, because you've, you know.
Not journalism at all. Okay. You know, I'm writing articles now to support this memoir, but right. I'm not a journalist. I'm a book editor.
Ah, okay.
Specifically in the areas of law, business, finance, some trade, you know, I had edited some memoirs. So I've been the invisible mender. I've not been visible. Now I'm out there, you know, sort of in everyone's face about something I was very secretive about for 20 years, which is quite surreal.
One of the things is, though, you mentioned having that drink at the end of the day, but, you know, you think you've deserved it because you've had a hard day. And you think you've been working hard, so you have a hard day. And it gets to the point where you can sort of put up a face, can't you? You can put up a happy face or put on an act if people don't sort of see the consequences. Were there any sort of consequences of these two glasses of wine, or was it the fact that the two glasses of wine were becoming the two glasses of wine at lunch or the bottle in the afternoon?
No. I was on the spectrum of what they call now alcohol use disorder. I was in the area that's called grey area drinking. I passed for normal. I often wondered what was normal, what normal people drank, how they drank two, how some people drank one. I could not get my head around one as a concept. But I passed, you know, I was a marathon runner. I was trekking in the Himalaya. I was walking across England. And I could go for periods of weeks not having a drink, particularly if I'd set myself a task that required me to train, you know, get up at 4:30 in the morning and run around Central Park, which I did every morning. I was in New York just about, and I was in New York every year. I wanted to pass for normal. I could pass for normal because I was very high functioning. And on the scale, on that spectrum, I had not fallen off the far end. I wasn't drinking in the morning. I hadn't lost a driver's license. And some people will say, if I'm not an alcoholic, therefore I can still drink. But if you're on the spectrum in that grey area, it's not giving you any joy, you know. And I was now 60, facing 60, and thinking, is this how I want to spend the rest of my life, putting all of this energy into trying to just, you know, minimize the wobbles, to stay upright and stable and under the radar and credible in my professional life. That is a lot of energy, which could be better used elsewhere. So, you know, I was trading off more and more, you know, this whole thing of what you trade off, self-respect and dignity. And as a single senior woman, dignity was really important to me, you know, so very important.
You kind of get aware there's a little, you know, it's what's saying, it's a disease and it's being ill at ease. And you're aware that something just quite isn't right. You're not quite comfortable in your own skin. You know, there's something, it's like having an itch that you can't really scratch and it's always ticking away and it gets in your mind and you find yourself always thinking about it. And that's not what normal people do. So how do you go about dealing with that then? I mean, do you do the group thing? Do you seek professional help? Or do you get out and think, right, I'm going to tackle this in a different way and I'm going to go around the world? Because other people, you know, you hear stories of people doing what's called a geographical, and it doesn't work. You know, they go, oh, I'm going to go to a new place. It can be the other side of the world. It can be a new town. And they think, I'm going to rock up there. I'll get sober. You know, nobody knows my past and whatever's happened, wherever I've been, presumably. And 9 times out of 10, it doesn't work. So how did you deal with it?
Well, I had to change myself, not just where I was. I love traveling. You know, I was doing geographicals all the time, but I didn't call them geographicals. I'm fascinated by new places and becoming part of a community or creating a community around myself. But as I say, I was the title of my memoir, Skinful, relates to Skinful being a way to describe having had enough alcohol to make you drunk. I was uncomfortable in my skin and, you know, I was fracturing. I felt that I was fracturing. I was so ashamed of who I thought I was on the inside. And it was like a shell that was, you know, starting to get cracks. And there are two pivotal experiences that I describe in the book that trace the narrative arc of when I was so uncomfortable in my skin to when I was comfortable in my skin. Finally, I had come back together like Humpty Dumpty had been, you know, reassembled. And then the whole thing of shedding an old skin for a new one. And the overriding theme of my book is that it's never too late to make a new path to a different future. And I say make, not take, and I'm often misquoted. Make, I'm very much about you are responsible for your own life. And, you know, like any adult, I came out of my childhood slightly bent out of shape, slightly. On that spectrum, I was very lucky, you know, but out of shape enough that I developed behaviours to try and numb pain or fill a void. These are the two classic preconditions for addiction. And everyone has those to a degree. No one has perfect parents. My parents have been damaged by their childhoods, but they were well-intentioned mostly. They were just inexperienced and they were overstressed and, you know, their hands were full. I did a writing workshop in New York around the time I started writing this book and we were given an opening sentence. And I realized working on that from about the age of 4, there was no hand for me to hold in my family. My parents had four young children and I was the eldest. So anyway, I had to surrender. I had to understand that this was not something I could control. And it was something I didn't want to try and control any longer because of the energy that it required. And I surrendered. But the third, the beginning of part 4 in the memoir is when I surrender. And I had a plan at the end of part 3 of what I was going to do that day. I was actually going to go to a 12-step recovery group meeting. And at the beginning of part 4, surprise, surprise, I walked away from that solution until I stopped dead in my tracks. And basically said, what am I doing? I cannot do this anymore. And so I had to find a way to believe that I could survive for one day without drinking, whatever happened. And then you know, life is an accumulation of single days. And I found that the next day, if I had a plan, I identified meetings to go to. And I went to that meeting that night. I went to a lot of, I started seeing a lot of films. I was in New York at this time. I started seeing a lot of films downtown at 5 o'clock instead of having the first glass of wine at 5 o'clock. And, but, you know, I'm not, I can't stand straight in a queue. I'll always stand off to the side a bit, you know, and I'm the same in my recovery. I'll do it my way, you know, because I'm a pain. I can do it. But, you know, I was brought up under such a controlling father that's not a solution to me to surrender responsibility for myself.
There's a, you know, there's a thing there about, you said, you know, when you get to the fourth part and you're going to go to a meeting and you turn around because you go, well, I don't need to do this. But, you know, it's when you're high functioning and you've got a brilliant career, you've got a brilliant job, you're doing what you love, and everything, you know, you're ticking all the boxes apart from that one that, you know, you really need to tick anyway. I mean, the concept of surrender and the concept of going, oh, for goodness sakes, you know, just deal with this, is actually quite alien, because we live in such control of our lives. We like to think that we've got it all managed. You know, we like to think that we know, we like to think that we've got this life thing and it's, you know, we can handle whatever it throws at us. And so the concept of actually going, you know, I'm in total control, I'm independent, I'm freelance, I'm single, I'm, you know, I've made it, look at my career so far, look at my glittering trophies behind me. So the career, the actual theory of going, okay, I'm not handling it and I'm going to tell a bunch of people about it, is actually the most frightening and horrendously seeming thing that you can do, you know, when you take a step through into that meeting.
Yes. Yes. Look, also, there was no easy solution to being me. I have what I call dummy spits, which are temper tantrums that a two-year-old would be proud of. And, you know, I could be a bit of a bully, you know. So it took me a long time to start to really grasp the concept that I had a part in any situation that, you know, that was unraveling. You know, and to look, okay, what was my part in this? And also to realize that, okay, I can have a dummy spit. It feels great sometimes, but you actually have to deal with the fallout afterwards and go back and apologize to people. And, you know, so there are scenes in the book where I had a dummy spit and then I had to go back and apologize. These were life skills that I learned late in life. I'm not going to say most normal people. I don't think there are most normal people. But a slightly more mature person than I might have learned sooner than I did.
So when you sort of stopped trying to control every aspect and if you like surrendered, how long did it take for things to start to sort of, strangely enough, click into place?
It took a while, Giles. It took a while. The book finishes 4 years after I had my last drink. And I'd been running in Central Park. As a global nomad, I frequently went back to places that I came to love: New York, Budapest, Florence, Sarawak. Kuching is the capital of Sarawak State in Malaysia. I have a very strong relationship with the people there. And and Reykjavik. You know, so I felt very at home in the world. I felt very at home in the world. And I felt, as I became more comfortable in myself, more confident that I could deal with anything that happened between when I woke up and when I went to bed at night, I started to notice more things around me, just little dynamics on the street, which gave me a lot of pleasure, you know. And I started to sort of develop my pleasure principle. Whereas I've been trying to numb my feelings, now I was more open to noticing and experiencing things. So that was a gradual process. But in 2015, just before, say, 4 years sober, I had an experience in Central Park that was, it was nothing. It was nothing, but for me it was everything. It was the exact opposite of a precipitating experience that I have a preview on page one of the book, but describe in more detail right in the middle of the book, was a turning point. This experience was the exact opposite. Every aspect of it was the opposite. But what had changed wasn't all of those things. What had changed was me. I had changed on the inside. And actually my working title for the book for many years had been Where in the World Are My Orange Underpants?
Okay.
And these are a question
that I find myself asking most days myself.
Well, I have a very soft spot for those undies. I bought them in Switzerland on a trek and they went round the world with me and had adventures of their own. And they were going to be a metaphor for home. Where are my orange underpants? Where is home? Home is in me. home could finally be in me, which meant I could be at home anywhere. So it's a bit of a hero's journey, you know, without getting too full of myself. It is, but it's one that anyone can experience, because it's never too late to say, you know, particularly as I'm now sort of a senior, God, you know, there's a sense that there's a limited amount of quality time left anyway, you know. And, you know, I walk past, I'm staying in King's Cross in Sydney, which is, you know, a pretty rough area, and there are people just lying on the footpath drunk.
The thing is, you know, after what we've been through, and indeed in Australia, you're still going through, you know, quite severely, what with restrictions and everything, you know, during the pandemic, during the situation where we were in lockdown, you must feel grateful that you're not still using or drinking or whatever, because during lockdown that could have been an absolute, because a lot of quote unquote normal people thought, right, we're in lockdown, we can open the breakfast Beaujolais, you know, we can have a drink at 11 o'clock because we're not going to be doing anything for the day. It was like that period between Christmas and New Year for a considerable period of time. But for, you know, for people who have these issues, I mean, lockdown was a real kick in the orange underpants, basically.
Yes. But, you know, my book is subtitled a memoir of addiction, as not just one addiction. You know, I have a very unhealthy relationship with Häagen-Dazs.
Oh yeah, we've been there. Those HDA meetings are quite something, aren't they? Häagen-Dazs Anonymous, yeah.
But yeah, gratitude is one of my, I don't stand directly behind someone in a queue. I purposely stand up to the side, but I am grateful. I'm very grateful that I found the willingness to surrender. You know, after you do that, really, you don't really have to do anything, I don't think.
What was it like then when you put all this down? You know, it on the page, on the laptop, you know, because you can write about anything, you can edit anything because, you know, you're good at what you do. But when it's your own stuff and it's there in black or white or whatever font you're writing, whatever shade you're writing, it is quite different. And you do go, blimey, O'Reilly, did I do this? And you know, here I am. I'm still standing after all that. And obviously, B, the point of writing the book is to not just to say, look at me, I did it, but also say to anybody, look, if I can do it, and you're in trouble, you can do it too.
Absolutely. A memoir is really, my memoir is based on my experience, but it is, my experience is illustrative of more universal or experiences that other people might share and come to my book looking for an answer. I'm not a known person and someone wants to read my biography or autobiography. They come with questions of their own. And I think it's questions like, am I normal? Can I, you know, how can I change at this time? Is it too late to change? My book addresses those questions. The hardest thing, it took 6 years to write Giles. I'd never written a book of this nature. And I found it incredibly difficult. Not so much in the sense of exposing myself, although I had to come at that actually, that layer of the content was the last to add. You know, it was a very long writing process. The difficulty for me was crafting a book that would engage people page after page after page after page. And yet that's the business I'm in. I didn't realise, you know, that is such hard work to do that. But I had good advice. I went to professionals all the way along. I had it reviewed by, you know, writing groups. I'm a professional. I put it in the hands of professionals in every aspect, because I knew that I was going to get one chance at this, and I wanted it to be, because I'm a perfectionist and I wanted it to do the job that I wanted it to do as well as possible, because there's a lot of, it can offer hope to people, particularly women 40 plus, I think that's really, you know, although it's not only for women, but that these are the people who break my heart when I see them struggling.
The book is called Skinful, A Memoir of Addiction. It's by Robin Fleming, who we've been speaking to today. Robin, if people want to find you on the social medias, is there a website? Where can people find out what you're up to?
My book website is called robinflemingauthor.com.
And that's, and Robin, that's Robin with a Y, isn't it, of course?
Robin with a Y, Fleming, two M's, author.com. And there are a lot of reader comments there. I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook. The book is available through Lantern Publishing, who's my UK publisher, and Book Depository, which delivers everywhere in the world, and Amazon.
And it's available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore as well, Robin. So there you go. There's a million and one ways people can get hold of it. There you go then. Only one more question to ask. So, where exactly are the orange underpants at this moment?
I suspect they were thrown aside by my lover in Bali beside a rice paddy.
Ah, that happens all the time with me. That happens all.
I think that's the last time I saw them.
Well. If they're going to end up anywhere, I suppose Bali was always going to be Bali. This book is called Skinful, and A Memoir of Addiction. It's by the wonderful Robin Fleming, who we've been speaking to today. Robin, it's been an absolute pleasure. Enjoy the rest of Invasion Day, Australia Day. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you, Charles.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.